This is The Takeaway for Friday, September 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us. And today, we start with you.
Hi, this is Nina Hoffman calling from Charleston, South Carolina. If I were hit with an emergency, I would be able to handle it. We have health insurance, homeowners, and flood. And while we don't have any savings, we could get as much credit as we might need. But what's scary is that now we are in the minority of the populace. What point might we become part of the majority?
My name is Tracy. I'm from Wells. No, we are not prepared. We live paycheck to paycheck. I'm on disability for my MS, and my husband has a small construction business. Ever since the recession, when my husband lost his job, we have been struggling.
Hi, my name is Chris from Millbrae, California. Me, my wife, and daughter are all financially prepared for any natural disasters or unexpected health issues. We have excellent employment, financial independence, and top-notch insurance covering our health and property. No worries at all.
Hi, this is Paul calling from Chinatownship, Michigan. My answer is absolutely not. We're still paying on thousands of dollars in medical bills because of a $6,000 deductible. Thank you, Obamacare. We live hand-to-mouth, even with two incomes. We'd survive somehow, as we always do, but we just might be paying on our debt till we go to the grave.
Are you and your family prepared for an emergency? That's the question we asked in the wake of Harvey and its devastating aftermath. The storm made landfall as a hurricane last Friday and has now left a trail of destruction across Texas and the Gulf. Scientists at the University of Wisconsin Space Science and Engineering Center are calling this a 1,000-year flood event. The damage to infrastructure and to people's lives in some ways is unfathomable. It's the kind of disaster few of us could ever truly prepare for. And in the weeks ahead, the financial costs will become a reality for millions of people. According to a new survey conducted by the Harris Poll and The Takeaway, only 10% of 1,200 American adults said they are very prepared for a natural disaster. Now, preparedness can mean a lot of things, and we're going to return to those findings in just a minute. But first, let's address financial vulnerability across America. That can come from a catastrophe like Harvey, but much more often, it's just a part of everyday life. Jonathan Mordick is a professor of public policy and economics at the NYU Wagner School. He's co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Courtney Collins is the lead reporter of the One Crisis Away Project from KERA Radio in Dallas. They've been tracking North Texans living on the financial edge for more than 4 years. And Courtney says it's not about being rich or poor. It's about the unexpected problems of daily life that can destroy a family's finances.
One crisis away doesn't mean that you're struggling with poverty and homelessness necessarily. Being one crisis away could mean that you have a job, but you have no savings. It could mean that you have two incomes, but you're so tightly budgeted that if anything changes, if there's any disruption to your finances, you're going to be kind of on the financial edge and have a major life disaster occur as a result. And what we're finding is that more and more people are living in what's known as asset poverty, meaning they really don't have the resources socked away to last more than about 3 months after a disruption to their finances.
Jonathan, how much savings does the average American family have to deal with an emergency situation? And how far away, if there's a way to know this, are average American families from the kind of financial crisis that Courtney's talking about?
The savings data is a little bit complicated, and we often have a go-to number, which isn't actually that useful. It's our U.S. savings rate, and that's about 5.7%. But it doesn't, that's an average. So the averages aren't that revealing. What's really more revealing are surveys which are starting to show, for example, that a third of Americans report having no savings at all, or 44% of Americans couldn't cover $400 if an emergency hit them. It's those kinds of numbers which are starting to get people to, you know, sit up and look at this differently.
But Jonathan, the American way is you might have a tight income, tight expenses, you save, you scrimp, you're not extravagant, you get by, get that better job, get that promotion, and before you know it, you'll be more comfortable. You won't be on the verge of crisis. Isn't that how it's supposed to be?
That's exactly how it's supposed to be. And you know what's interesting is we see households in our own work, and we have a study where we followed American families from different parts of the U.S. We see them saving. just like they're supposed to do. But because of the ups and downs, and some of them, you know, of the sort that Courtney's describing, because of those ups and downs, the saving is getting depleted. So they're actively trying to save through the year, but they're not ending up with accumulations. And that's leaving them vulnerable when those big things happen.
Courtney, let's talk about some of the big things, because you reported on the wave of tornadoes that tore through Texas in 2015 and some of the people who survived those storms. Of course, we've been talking all week about the devastation on the other side of Texas down in Houston and the surrounding area, and so many people who lost their homes. We don't even know the extent of that damage yet. Talk about those big shocks and what they can mean for people.
And I just actually revisited some of those families this week after Hurricane Harvey because I wanted to check in with them and kind of get their take on the situation. And it's really interesting. When the tornadoes came through, it was the day after Christmas in 2015. You know, you had two categories of people, people that had insurance and people that didn't. You know, we all know that renters aren't required to carry insurance a lot of the time. And we did have a family that we followed that had no renter's insurance at all. Their rental house was torn to pieces. They lost everything inside of it. And worse still, the husband in that family had a job as a general contractor, had a work truck full of tools, and only carried liability insurance on it. He had no full coverage. So when that truck got smashed by the tornado, all those tools and the truck itself were gone, and he had to replace those things out of pocket because they had no coverage, no full coverage on that truck, just the required minimum liability insurance. So that was a big shock, obviously, to that family. They went from having a house full of things, a kitchen full of food, closets full of clothes, to nothing. And no real way to replace it. It's not like they had a savings. There was a reason they didn't carry those kinds of insurances. It's because they were so tightly budgeted that they just could not part with that money each month. They used it for bills and food. And so they were in a real bind. Then we talked to a lot of people that were underinsured, where they had either renter's insurance on their apartment or homeowner's coverage on their duplex or home. But when the time came to rebuild, they just really couldn't see how their coverage was going to stretch through to a full rebuild. You know, North Texas has a really hot housing market. And when there's a disaster, contractors go quickly, building supplies go quickly, and it's hard to rebuild. It's expensive. And people don't naturally go scrutinize their insurance policy every 6 to 12 months. They don't necessarily go through it anytime they make a big purchase or add a family member. You just don't ever really think it's going to happen to you. That's what the folks I talked to said over and over again. While they felt like they could handle it, and while, of course, they had some safeguards in place, it just never really occurred to them that they'd be picking through rubble at their house one day.
Jonathan, we talked yesterday with an expert on flood insurance who was looking at the Houston area, and only 2 out of every 10 homes in that area are covered by flood insurance. Now everybody's situation is different, but when you look at that broad picture of non-insurance for homes, you must see thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are going to be faced with a crisis here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something that the nation as a community is going to have to help the Houston community deal with. I think what Houston and the problems that we're seeing today are highlighting is a much broader phenomenon. It's those devastating moments. It's also health issues. A lot of people have insurance, as Courtney's saying, but not enough. So often having, you know, insurance that has high deductibles and high co-insurance, which means that when something happens, they have insurance, but it doesn't pay out that much, or they're huge out-of-pocket expenses. And so we're seeing Americans, you know, skipping medical treatments. About a quarter of Americans report they skipped medical treatments they needed because it was just too costly. So there's insurance, but the markets aren't really working so well for households that are really squeezed.
Courtney, outside of the disaster zone that we've been looking at this week, how important is medical insurance and the quality of health coverage to being one crisis away in America?
I've seen time and time again that medical expenses are a big reason that people are struggling. What's interesting to me, though, is it hasn't been families complaining about not having insurance or not having good enough insurance. It's just the fact that there's so many people that have to pony up, say, $1,200 to get a surgery, and they do it because that's part of their deductible and they haven't met it yet. But that $1,200 that they've now put toward that surgery is either out of savings or is out of their general expense account, and all of a sudden, they're throwing stuff on the credit cards. We had a couple that we chronicled in the very first chapter of our One Crisis Away series almost 4 years ago, and they were young. They had a little boy, and right after their son was born, Isaac, who is the husband, he got very, very sick. And they found out he had a really rare blood disorder, and he was basically out of the workforce from that day forward. He was in and out of the hospital for a couple of years, and he passed away. And when that happened to that family, they went from two earners to one. She ended up renting out their home to someone just to make some money, moved in with her parents, with her little boy, and says that when the medical bills comes, she literally stacks them on the table and puts them in a drawer when the stack gets too high because she can't afford to pay them.
Jonathan, what are the types of things that American families are skipping or foregoing or just doing without as the bills stack up or as they're trying to meet month-to-month expenses before the crisis even comes?
So there's a lot of juggling. And what we've seen in our work following families over a year is that households have been pretty adept at trying to figure out, you know, which bills they can pay or not pay without getting things cut off. And so the big things often are medical. Some food gets cut. We see that, you know, when people are running out of food before the next paycheck, you know, consumption really does take a dip. It's basic necessities which are getting cut. And that's a tough equation, especially, you know, a family with kids trying to keep everything together.
I jump in and say families are also really creative. They know how long their grace periods are on all of their bills. I talked to a woman who says she literally has a chart and she knows how many days over she can go on each payment before it gets reported a credit, before she actually gets a late fee assessed. And she takes it to the down to the quick every single month. And her famous line is, "My month is so much longer than my paycheck is."
Courtney, we're talking a lot about the financial pressure and the financial stress on families. That's only part of it. I mean, the psychological and emotional toll when you're going through this type of financial stress has to be enormous, and it has to be enormous on kids as well.
I've been told that. I've been told that poverty is trauma. We know that kids in poverty start kindergarten about a year behind their peers. Something really interesting I was told by someone who works at the school here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that kind of emphasizes social emotional health and caters to low-income kids, is she told me that living in poverty, the feeling a child has is equivalent to what you and I feel if we slam on the brakes on the highway to try to avoid a car crash. That feeling you get where your heart kind of leaps into your throat and your pulse races, that's how a child living in poverty feels constantly. Imagine living with that as a 7-year-old day in and day out. That's why they call it toxic stress. And that's why I think it erodes so many of these kids' skills early on and why they start school so behind.
So where do people start? If wages aren't rising for working families as fast as they used to, nowhere near as fast, what can they do?
It's a tough equation. And it does have to come down to pulling down debt and trying to save more. I think the big problem is that a lot of the policy and a lot of the financial products that are available don't really fit households that are in these unstable situations. And so we're starting to see some approaches, for example, new technologies that are run through a smartphone and track what a household's income is doing month by month and is automatically pulling some money out when income is unnaturally high or abnormally high and putting that into savings automatically. What doesn't work is the usual advice, which is, you know, save automatically a given chunk of your income because that chunk, you know, may not be there month to month, depending on how big your paycheck is. So you need something that's much more active and that rides up and down with the ups and downs of incomes. So technology can help, but there are also things that, you know, policy can do. For example, we have lots of help saving up for retirement if you've got a job with a retirement policy. One thing that we could imagine is a similar kind of policy that would help people build up emergency savings.
What would that look like, an emergency savings policy?
Well, there's a really interesting idea that's been floated, which is something called a sidecar account, so that every month, you know, as a few percentage of your income is put into a retirement account, another percentage or so goes into an emergency savings account. So it just comes off the top.
Should Americans be able to save in a sidecar account tax-free?
That is a really interesting question. Right now, we have lots of subsidies for saving, and it's mostly going to richer people. It would be a great thing to see more of that kind of support and subsidy going to, you know, the struggling bottom half of the American population.
Jonathan Mordick is professor of public policy and economics at NYU and co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Courtney Collins is lead reporter on the One Crisis Away project from KERA Public Radio in Dallas. We return now to that Harris poll that I mentioned at the top of our program today. In a survey of 1,200 people that Harris conducted with The Takeaway, Americans are split on whether they're prepared for a natural disaster like Hurricane Harvey. The survey also revealed that Americans will most often turn to a family member and personal resources if a crisis like Harvey were to strike them. About a third said they would depend on family, while 16% would rely on insurance, and just 15% would go to a personal emergency fund. Those are just some of the findings. So for more on the results, we turn to John Gersma. He's CEO of the Harris Poll. John, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Todd.
You at the Harris Poll surveyed 1,200 Americans, as I mentioned, on their perceptions of how prepared they feel for a natural disaster like Harvey. What did you find?
Well, surprisingly, Americans are split down the middle about whether or not they feel that they are prepared for a disaster such as Hurricane Harvey. And you see that 50% say that they're very or somewhat prepared, but the other half of us say that we're not at all or not too prepared.
What do we know about what being prepared actually means? Because being prepared could be everything from I have a disaster kit, I have a plan, and I have a bunch of flashlights to, you know, I have $10,000 in savings for something like this.
Well, that's what gets really interesting in this, Todd, is that when you go inside the numbers, you actually see that there's a lack of confidence of Americans feeling that they've got a personal plan in place. In fact, only 10% of the country feel they're very prepared for a natural disaster. And with 41% of us saying that we feel unprepared for a long-term power outage or other event, you know, where that would require food, water, or supplies for more than 3 days.
What are some of the regional differences you found? Are there differences north to south?
There are. What I thought was quite interesting was depending on where you live, perhaps for most notably in the south, where 57% of folks in the south said that they felt they were very or somewhat prepared. Again, you know, somewhat follows sort of the patterns of whether or not natural disasters tend to be more of a function of the region that you live in, and that becomes more of a cultural aspect of where you are.
So I was struck by this finding that very few people, or relatively few people, I should say, plan to rely on their own savings or even on insurance coverage that they might have. A lot of people in this survey said they would turn to family or friends. That doesn't necessarily tell you the resources that family or friends have available. So dig into those numbers for us a little bit.
Sure, Todd. I thought what was also interesting was that a big part of this worry seems to be having a safety net. As you mentioned, only 15% of Americans have and believe they could turn to a personal emergency fund, or 16% feel that they can rely on insurance. So really what they tend to be doing is focusing on their family in the event of a crisis.
And I assume we can't know too much about how many of those people have insurance that they won't use, or how many people can afford insurance or just don't have it.
No, we don't have that inside the data. But I thought what was quite interesting was when we asked this question around where would you turn to for support in terms of your local community, and surprisingly, only 10% of us said that we would turn to our local communities, and yet 62% of Americans reported that they were very or somewhat confident in their local community to respond to a natural disaster such as what we've had in Houston this week.
So there's a disconnect there. People are confident that their communities could help them, but they still seem kind of individualistic, at least in their predictions of how they would act.
Yeah, I think so. I think what perhaps they're saying is that we are all of us are sort of caught up in our own world with our own devices, and yet when we stop and really survey the loss and devastation of the events this week, as Americans have been following what's been happening in the Houston region, you suddenly start to remember and recollect, you know, the power of ordinary Americans to come together.
John Gersma is CEO of the Harris Poll. They're a public opinion market research and strategy firm that conducted this poll of 1,200 Americans with The Takeaway. John Gersma, thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman of Newsday is here, not with his usual movie reviews, but with a trip 4 decades back in time and millions of light years out in space. Rafer's here with a moment in sci-fi history that left alien footprints across pop culture as soon as it hit the big screen.
Two science fiction landmarks were released in 1977. One was a rousing adventure in a galaxy far, far away.
Can't get out that way.
Looks like you managed to cut off our only escape route.
Maybe you'd like it back in your cell, Your Highness.
The other was a very different film. Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
The traffic's not lower than us. It's 1 o'clock now, still above me and descending.
Aries 31, can you say aircraft type?
Negative, Center. No distinct outline. That's the brightest any collision lights I think I've ever seen. Alternating white to red.
Close Encounters doesn't have any laser guns or talking androids. It's about three people who believe in the existence of alien life. Richard Dreyfuss plays Roy Neary, a working-class guy who encounters something he can't understand and begins seeing visions he can't explain.
Well, I guess you've noticed something that's a little strange with Dad.
Francois Truffaut plays a professional UFOlogist.
Monsieur Neary, please, one more question.
And Melinda Dillon is a mother whose little boy is abducted by aliens. That scene, in a rural house in the dead of night, is one of Spielberg's best moments. Back in 1977, The Hollywood Reporter called Close Encounters a film of incredible power and intensity. Vincent Canby in The New York Times said the film's final scene was as beautiful as anything I've seen since 2001, A Space Odyssey. The movie also became a $300 million hit, and no wonder. Close Encounters is a total crowd pleaser. It's scary, thrilling, funny, and it's optimistic. In this story, the aliens aren't greeted by soldiers, but by scientists. And the climactic scene isn't a battle, but a conversation. It turns out the aliens speak the universal language of music.
These phrases have in common are 5 seconds.
I hope somebody's taking all this down.
What are we saying to each other?
It seems they're trying to teach us a basic tonal vocabulary.
It's the first day of school, fellas.
It's remarkable how contemporary Close Encounters feels today, probably because it's been copied so often. It was the first film to use a cloud tank, basically an aquarium with a milky liquid poured in to create those billowing cloud effects in the sky. It also broke with sci-fi tradition by casting the aliens not as invaders, but as peaceful, even childlike creatures. And the whole premise of Close Encounters, the attempt to communicate, keeps resurfacing in the movies. Think of last year's Oscar-winning film Arrival, starring Amy Adams as a linguist trying to decipher an alien code.
Louise. I am Louise.
What is that? Is that a new symbol? I can't tell.
Dr. Banks? Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. They need to see me.
Take it off her head, Master. Dr. Banks?
Cool.
Is she okay?
You're risking contamination.
They need to see me.
Dr. Banks?
She's walking toward the screen.
Sony Pictures is re-releasing Close Encounters in a 4K digital restoration that should sharpen the special effects designed by the great Douglas Trumbull of 2001. But the magic of this movie isn't just in the effects. It's in the dialogue, the humor, that great moment when Richard Dreyfuss tries to create an alien landing pad from a pile of mashed potatoes, or when that unnamed keyboard player just stares in awe at the massive mothership. The real magic of Close Encounters is in its humanity.
Close encounter with something very unusual. Who are you people?
For The Takeaway, I'm Rafer Guzman.
As the country prepares for Labor Day this weekend, we want to spend a little time thinking about the middle class and how Americans get there. Entering the middle class, being solidly middle class, it's at the center of that story we tell ourselves about the American dream. Get an education, get a job, work hard, and that's how you come out on top in this country. But as you heard earlier in the hour, being in the middle class does not mean your financial troubles are necessarily gone. Not anymore. The rules have simply changed in America. Automation, wage stagnation, steep increases in tuition, and yes, corporate profit all mean that the work hard and get ahead rulebook simply no longer works for a lot of Americans. all mean that the work hard and get ahead rulebook simply no longer works for a lot of Americans. Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor under President Clinton from 1993 to 1997. He also served in the administrations of President Ford and President Carter, and he's currently Professor of Public Policy at the University of California. Robert Reich says defining the middle class today is pretty much impossible to do.
Well, there is no official definition of the middle class. People who look at the economy and look at workers typically measure the middle class as, first of all, the median income, that is the person who's smack in the middle, equal number of people above, equal number of people below, and then look at incomes that are 50% above and 50% below that median.
All right, so that's middle class statistically. Let's talk a little bit about what middle class means in the real economy in terms of how much money you get, what you can buy, and what kind of life you can have with you and your children.
It depends a lot on where you live. For example, if you are in New York City or Boston or San Francisco, in order to afford even a living space, you're going to probably have to earn $150,000, $175,000. And even then, we are hearing a lot of complaints by people of that income level that they can't afford a good life in San Francisco. A family with two kids in the heartland of the country would probably need anywhere from $50,000 to $90,000 to feel that they could afford a home with two bedrooms. They could afford what they need. They're not going to be leading a luxurious lifestyle, but we're talking about a place where housing costs are relatively lower than they are in many places around the country, and also where other costs of living are more modest.
One of the things we want to talk about, Mr. Secretary, are alternative paths to the middle class. We've heard a lot about this over recent years. As manufacturing has dwindled in this country, if you didn't go to four-year college, can we still rely on that? And if not, how do we start to talk about alternatives?
We cannot rely on manufacturing because even though the percentage of the economy that is based on manufacturing has not dwindled nearly as much as a lot of people fear it has, the number of jobs or percentage of our total jobs in manufacturing is far less because manufacturing is filled with computers and numerically controlled machine tools and robots. They're doing the work. Technology is taking away manufacturing jobs. And so manufacturing is certainly not the answer. And so the big question for a lot of people is, what's the route? What's the route into the middle class? And the typical answer is you have to go to college. You've got to get a four-year college degree. That can't be the total answer.
Well, if that can't be the total answer, what's the economic case for an alternative? I mean, we can't just conjure another path, of course. What are some of the new ideas?
I think we have to develop an alternative route, technical and vocational education, but not just the way we've been doing it, which is kind of a third tier for the dropouts and the kids who are not going to make it. I'm talking about a world-class vocational technical education, ways in which young people who don't get a four-year college degree can nonetheless learn to gain mastery over an area of technology so that they can subsequently learn on the job.
You're talking about a focused education with real economic relevance, computer programming, healthcare, even plumbing, things like that.
Yes, but also bear in mind that we are in the midst of a huge revolution in information technology and artificial intelligence. A lot of new machinery is flooding into hospitals and offices and elsewhere, but you need people to install it, to repair it, to upgrade it, to monitor it. And these specialists are going to be the new kind of technicians of the future. We don't have enough of them.
Robert Reich, I know we're talking about the future here and not the past, but it does seem to me that what you're advocating for here, unfortunately, is a great deal of backfill. Nobody really thought to put a little bit of money into the community colleges and vocational schools and the type of education that you're talking about that might have prevented this very conversation.
No, we're doing almost nothing. Community colleges have been starved for resources relative to their importance. We also need to promote the last year of high school and the maybe first 2 years of community college as the building block, as the key building block. And then also to develop what might be called skill ladders. That is, ways in which young people, once they get some of those critical skills, they can show to future employers that they have them, maybe take a simple qualifying exam or get a certificate, and that becomes the first rung on a ladder that enables them to show even greater mastery as they gain greater understanding. And then, again, view this as a lifelong learning process, because many of these technologies are changing so quickly that once you gain mastery over a particular domain of technology, you want to continue to upgrade those skills.
But if we do all these things, Robert Reich, exactly as you say, and the incentives work out, if wages are broadly stagnated, they've been moving a little bit in the last couple of years, but doesn't that mean that even if you choose a different path to the middle class, that traffic is just moving a lot more slowly on all the paths than it once did?
Yeah, this is not a solution to the bigger problem, but the big, big challenge is wages and compensation. And as technology continues to replace more and more jobs, it seems to me we've got to get very serious about something called a universal basic income. And the first step would be to enlarge the earned income tax credit. That is a wage subsidy. It was invented by conservative economist Milton Friedman. It's now the largest anti-poverty policy in the federal government. And we've got to enlarge it because a lot of wages are just not going to be enough.
Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Secretary, thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
And be sure to join us again on Monday, this Labor Day. We're going to continue our conversation with Robert Reich, and we're going to talk about what it might take to change the American story a little bit, and that maybe a college education doesn't always offer the best chance of reaching the middle class. It's been a week since Hurricane Harvey made landfall in Texas, downgrading from a tropical storm and stalling over the coastal towns from Corpus Christi and Rockport to Houston and Port Arthur. It's being called the most extreme rain event in American history.
It happened very quickly, and a lot of people were caught off guard because Saturday, I mean, it did seem like a normal day. So even though people were being warned, this rain is coming, there's potential for flooding, it just seemed like it had passed Houston.
It started at 2 a.m., and we were in our house until it got to about mid-thigh.
We've got a lot of houses and businesses that have been impacted by flooding. We have several thousand of our Houstonians that have been evacuated and are in shelters. And, you know, we are hurting a little bit, but we're not broken, and we'll overcome this. That's what I think we are all about as Texans and as Americans.
There's so many of people that want to already start to help and volunteer, and it's kind of an amazing situation here in Houston.
So far, we have been able to save over 330 animals.
But, you know, at the end of the day, brother, it's just property. And we'll rebuild and move on from there. I'm just glad to be out of that mess.
Well, the rebuilding is still in their future in South Texas, and there's an overwhelming amount of mess to clean up. But communities show their resilience at times like this, and South Texas is no different. Joining me now are two voices from the community in Houston. Vernon Loeb, he's the managing editor of the Houston Chronicle, with about 200 reporters who've been on the front lines of this storm and its aftermath. Also with us is Amanda K. Edwards, a native Houstonian and current Houston City Council member at large, who's been out across the streets of the city all this week. Amanda, Vernon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Vernon, you have reporters, as I mentioned, all throughout the region who've been covering this day in and day out. What's the story now in Houston and all over the area?
I think the story now is that the recovery has begun, and hundreds of thousands of people are left with the reality of going back to their homes and ripping out drywall and carpet and you know, starting to rebuild their homes. I'm sure we're going to have hundreds of thousands of homeowners and property owners in that situation over the next days, weeks, probably months.
Amanda, you're at large on the city council, as I mentioned, and that means you represent the whole city. You've been out there on the streets, sometimes floating in boats, I'm sure, talking to people and constituents. What are some of the urgent needs at this time? What are you hearing?
Right now, I think people are in need of good information, number one. For many, unfortunately, for many, they've flooded before, but not for the significant majority. And so what we have to do is make sure we're communicating with them. And also, there are going to be so many needs for so many people after longer term. And so making sure that we are not just focused on those residents who are harmed in their immediate needs, but rather thinking about this is a long recovery that will take place. And so a lot of people, a lot of organizations have been willing to give, and we appreciate that. But we want to make sure that we make sure that those resources are cash as well to the Greater Houston Community Foundation Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund.
And we've been talking all this week to takeaway listeners across the country about how they can help and how they can donate to aid the recovery effort in South Texas. So that's good for them to hear. Amanda, I know that you're city council. A lot of your job is financial, resources, cleanup, practical. Give me a sense of what people are saying to you about their lives, about their fears at this time.
It has been a very, I think, shocking event. People are very proud about the response in the after immediate crisis situation. And so you've been on this adrenaline for several days in a row. And so yesterday, as we were going to different residents, talking to them, they were pulling out, you know, sheetrock and, you know, all kinds of items from their homes. Talking to them, it was something that they seemed encouraged in terms of eventually being able to get past it. But you're going to have a lot of residual effects. Just because the sun is out and the waters are receding, for many people, they are still on crisis mode. And so dealing with how and what direction to send people and making sure that they are not being taken advantage of, that's a piece. Another piece is just wanting to feel like they're getting the support that they need to put the pieces back together for their lives.
Vernon Loeb, talk about the mission of your paper at this time. You have reporters all across the region, of course, but America saw these reports of how the Houston Chronicle passed out thousands, tens of thousands of free papers, not only in shelters, but all over the city.
Yeah, well, we took the pay meter down off one of our websites immediately so that it could be free. We were setting unbelievable traffic records on both our websites since the storm began about a week ago. And you know, it was a vast story in that it's a vast area. So we had reporters who are probably, you know, 50 or 100 miles apart almost trying to cover this thing. We still have reporters out in Fort Bend and Brazoria counties where actually the worst flooding for them may actually start today as the Brazos River crests and comes up over its banks at historic levels. So the story really isn't even over yet. And then, you know, as we know, a couple of days ago, the storm moved off into Port Arthur in Beaumont. So this is a huge area. Houston is a gigantic city. It's over 600 square miles. So just covering the city of Houston alone is a big task. And then to, you know, go beyond the region, it's really about eight counties. It's a very, very big piece of real estate that got just walloped by, you know, more rain than any of us have ever seen, over 50 inches in most parts of the region. Trillions and trillions of gallons of water fell on this region, and there's just no way anybody can deal with that much water.
Amanda K. Edwards, I want to give you the last word as a Houston native. The world is watching your town, of course. The nation is watching. This is where you're from. What do you want people to know about Houston now?
I want to first say thank you. People from all over the globe had interest in not just watching us have this travesty occur, but they were actually willing and interested and passionate about helping. And so that helped us to come together as a collective to make it through the storm. There's been a brand of Houston Strong circulating, and I think we believe we will rebuild. We do not believe that this storm, Hurricane Harvey, or its rainfall will defeat us in any way. We know it's a long road. We ask for continued prayer, support. And so that's the message I want people all over the world to understand and appreciate who we are, but then also know that we're appreciative of their interest and their compassion that they've exhibited to date.
Well, Amanda Edwards, we've been covering this story, of course, since last week, but I want you to know that we're pulling for you and that we're with you and that we also appreciate you joining us to share some of your city's story with us. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Amanda K. Edwards is an at-large Houston City Council member. And Vernon Loeb, thank you to you as well.
Thank you.
Vernon Loeb is managing editor of the Houston Chronicle. Well, it's been a hard week for millions of Americans along the Gulf, and a week that has a lot of people considering their own lives and situations. This hour, we've been turning to you. Are you financially prepared for an emergency?
This is Jim Curry. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio. And are we prepared for financial emergency? Well, not too much if it required more than what our health or homeowners insurance covers. But we at least have that. We have some consumer credit available, but no real reserve otherwise. The last many years have seen us struggling to stay even or above water, no pun intended, with our real income stagnant or maybe even declining.
Those are some of your voices on preparedness in the face of disaster in America. You can give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always send your tweets to us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state devoted to entrepreneurship and innovation. Learn more about the benefits of growing a startup or scale-up business in Arkansas at arkansasedc.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.